This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grim Walk in Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We are here to do our last champion script read for 2025. We're recording this in October, releasing in December, and I'm a little sad that I don't get to see my friends for a few days after this, but we're having so much fun putting these together, and I can't wait to start doing more content like this in the new year. Today we're going to be reading Champions 5, which is from April 1976. The writer on this book is Tony Isabella. Now Jenny Isabella. Don Heck is the artist, with John Tarkag on inks, Janice Cohen on colors, John Ostanza and Irv Watanabe on letters, and Marf Wolfman is the editor. I'm Chad Anderson. I'll be playing your narrator today.
Oh, I'm Christy Porter. I will be playing Black Widow, Woman in Orange, and Rose.
There's a comma there. The woman in orange and also Rose, not the woman in orange and Rose.
Oh, well, I thought it was clear that those were three different people, but thank you for also clarifying.
I'm Mike Rossi. I'll be playing Angel, number 13, and Manatee.
I'm Scott Free, and I will be playing Iceman and number 86.
I am Sean Perrette, and I will be playing Hercules and number 73.
I'm Kevin Canary, and I'll be Ivan Petrovich and Amos Crawley.
I'm Michael Hamm, and Ghost Rider's taking a back seat today, so I'll be playing Richard Finster, Emerson Bale, and Anna.
I'm Ryan Krall, and I'll be playing Rampage.
I love Rampage. We're going to have a great time with this villain. He's a lot of fun. The cover on this book is Rich Buckler and Don Adkins. Hercules occupies the cover box, looking down on Rampage fighting the champions. Murder is a man called Rampage, it says. He throws a metal stick into Angel and Iceman, knocking them together, shrugs off a widow's bite from Black Widow, and smashes a metal door into Hercules. He's dressed in a tech suit in red and yellow and silver and black in a truly bizarre color palette array. Stacks of cash are on the ground. Windows are shattered. Hard-working businessmen are scared. Hercules, Prince of Power! Black Widow, beautiful but deadly. The Ghost Rider, the most supernatural superhero of them all. The Angel and Iceman, two former X-Men, each seeking a life of his own. They are brought together to fight mankind's greatest foes because the world still needs heroes. Stan Lee presents the champions in The Economy is So Bad That, or These Days the Only Way to Get a Dollar to Go Far is to Toss It Out of an Airplane. It's the recession, folks. Here we go. Presenting the everyman of supervillains, the first menace born of the recession, Rampage! The cover page shows Rampage lashing out in a room full of machines, like he's kicking the industrial age right over. His skullcap is yellow, his goggles red, his shirt and tights are red with yellow gloves and inlay down the legs, and a gold corset at the waist. Tech pieces line the outside of his suit across the chest, down the arms and legs. The faces of Hercules, Black Widow, Iceman, and Angel stare, and they seem confused. Now we open in a lawyer's office. A portly man in a blue suit sits behind a desk with a stack of papers and a lit cigarette. Angel stands before his desk, wings out in full costume. A secretary in a slim-fitting black dress rushes out of the room, and Iceman, in full icy form, sits in a green upholstered chair, covering parts of it in frost. He's left tracks of icy footprints across the carpet. That just seems irresponsible, I'll just say that. Emerson Bale is one of the world's finest legal minds. His cases are landmark, his comments headlines. And Emerson Bale boasts a clientele encompassing senators and sports stars, millionaires and militants, and one mutant.
I appreciate everything you're doing for me, Mr. Bale. I've never been involved in the family finances before this. I wouldn't know where to begin.
Warren, your parents were my dearest friends. I'm not about to allow their son to be cheated out of his inheritance, not by those human sharks you call relatives. Their claims that your parents wouldn't have made you sole beneficiary if they had known that you were the Angel are sheer poppycock. They'll be laughed out of the court. I followed your exploits with the X-Men, my boy. I suspect the Warrington fortune would be put to far better use in your hands.
Warren's mutant identity became public knowledge in Champions number one when they had that fight at UCLA, everybody. And his parents were killed by his evil Uncle Dazzler in a story that we covered in the interim years between the end of the X-Men and the start of Giant Size.
You made it sound like I just inherited Fort Knox. I know my folks had money, but it's hardly a...
Before you finish that sentence, maybe you should see this partial list of their holdings.
Mind if I take a look, Warren? After working in my parents' corner store all those summers, it'd be interesting to get a gander at the world of big business.
Gander away, Frostbite, but I think you'll be disappointed. Oh,
Warren, that's more money than God makes.
Looking at the papers handed to him, Warren's face lights up. He tosses them into the air in a dramatic gesture.
Wow, I'm rich, I'm rich.
That you are, my boy. That you are.
Cut to, in a nearby office, another attorney, Amos Crawley, is treating his client very differently. Dressed in a gray jacket, bow tie, and blue pinstripe pants, Crawley is furious. His client, Stuart Clark, a man with jet black hair, dressed in a brown jacket with green and black striped tie, has just thrown a stack of unpaid bills in the air, having a little fit.
And what do you figure to gain from this childish display, Clark? Throwing your unpaid bills in the air won't solve your problems. Only paying them will. You owe, mister. The government. Your subcontractors. Even me, your lawyer. If you'd sold out 2 years ago, you could have been a rich man today. But now you've got to declare bankruptcy.
Declare bankruptcy? You spineless worm. Do you know what Clark Futuristics means to me? I put my soul into this company. Crawley. How could I sell my soul to some corporation?
Clark grabs Crawley's jacket lapel, slamming the attorney up against the wall, soon throwing him back to the floor.
You were handling my finances, Crawley. You are to blame for this.
Stuart, please.
Why didn't you plan for this blasted recession? It was tough enough competing with all the big outfits before. These idiots in Washington started running the economy into the ground. Why didn't you plan?
I...
Consider yourself fired, Crawley. I'll get in touch with you the next time I want a dream destroyed. And don't worry about my creditors. I'll find a way to pay them back. I'll find a way to pay them all back.
As Clark storms out of the building, he raises his fists into the air and screams. A woman in an orange dress sympathizes.
Ah, there goes another one. Between L.A. smog and the Republicans, we're all gonna flip out before long.
Oh, wow. Stuart Clark is one of the world's finest scientific minds. This morning, that mind has snapped. It is a loss that will directly affect two people we've come to know quite well, the Black Widow and Ivan Petrovich. On a nearby park bench, Black Widow's dressed in her superhero costume, but with an orange plaid vest and skirt over it. Her father figure, Ivan, has on a red turtleneck, his blue jacket and brown pants. Nearby, a group of football players are practicing.
Out with it, Ivan. All morning you've been pouting like Gary Cooper in High Noon. Or is that reference too recent for you?
It's that call you got from the Worthington kid. It sounds like bad news to me.
Bad? Warren's idea for the Champions.
Ain't that much different from the Avengers, or even your partnership with Daredevil. Not where it counts. Because every time you've ever tied up with anyone, you get burned inside where it really hurts. What makes you think it'll be different this time, my little Tsarina? What makes you think you won't get hurt again?
It's nothing that makes logical sense, old friend. Just a feeling. You know, the Champions are really a lot like us. Losers!
No, loners.
Loners!
How dare you?
Damn, read them.
I'll start over from the top. Just kidding. sorry, guys. That's a pretty good Freudian slip. It's nothing that makes logical sense, old friend. Just the feeling. You know, the Champions are a lot like us. Loners. Take the Angel and the Iceman. I don't believe they ever really felt comfortable as the X-Men. A group consisting solely of mutants probably didn't allow for much individual growth. Johnny Blaze is easy to figure out. He belongs to a West that doesn't exist anymore. And Hercules. What can it be like to belong nowhere? In Olympus, he's a man among gods. On Earth, a god among men. Ivan, I think it might work this time.
Okay, kid. I'll play it your way and pray I can pick up the pieces later.
They're losers just like us. Take Angel and Iceman, for instance. Hercules, nearby, holding a football, approaches the playing team.
In truth, young mortal, Hercules is still unsure as to the purpose of this air-filled bag.
Nothing to it, Mr. Hercules. I'll run through it one more time. The idea is to carry this air-filled bag across the goal line without those men trying to stop you.
Get ready, boys. You're about to become the first team in UCL history to tackle a mythological god.
The 11 of us will turn that guy into an Olympian pancake.
Hercules will do as thou dost request, mortal, but I do not fathom the importance of reaching yon goal line.
Good lord, do those college students have any inkling of what they're getting themselves into?
It looks like they're going to find out, sweetheart. Right about now. See?
The camera shifts back to the football players, who are all lying on the ground, flattened, groaning, with spinning heads. It's a touchdown for Hercules.
I wonder if it's too late to try out for the debating team.
Couldst thou enlighten me further, young ones?
And while the UCLA Bruins have second thoughts about their chosen field of athletic endeavor, another member of our ever-burgeoning cast is likewise contemplating his future activities. Dressed in a green suit and black tie, Richard Fenster walks down the road in shock. The editor reminds you of our adventures back in Champions number 1, where Richard Fenster was the guy that put the team together.
Fired. They fired me, as if I'm to blame for the damage Pluto's army did to the campus. But that's not the half of it. I have to tell Hercules and Widow that the university has no further need of their services either. Well, Richard Fenster, ex-lecture agent, what's next?
How about business manager of Champions Inc.?
Whoa. The angel plucks Fenster right off the ground and flies him up to drop him on a slide of ice made by Iceman.
The Iceman will give you the details, pal. Your first job is to find a suitable headquarters. Nothing too big. 20 or 30 floors ought to do it.
What's the matter, Fenster? Cold feet?
What the heck? Yeah, I accept.
The balance of life. One man rises on the very wings of hope, while his fellow sinks deeper in the bitter morass of despair. Walking into the offices of Clark Futuristics, Stuart Clark is in a bad place. Inside, his personal invention, a personalized suit of red and yellow armor with connectors that complete a power system once they all click into place. Click, 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 click.
They stacked the deck against me from the very beginning. Even when I first with a product, I could never supply it as economically or as rapidly as big outfits like Stark or Roxxon. I had high hopes for this exoskeleton uniform. It could have been revolutionized modern police work. But when Stark's LA operation started working on similar project, it got the fat government contract. Not me. Maybe there's another way I can utilize my investment, though. Maybe.
It had to happen eventually. The law of averages demanded it. Someone would develop the same lightweight and flexible alloys that turned a young Tony Stark into Iron Man, and then master the powerful magnetic forces necessary to join a sword of mechanical components into an invincible suit of armor. Stuart Clark is not an inherently evil man. He has been bent, twisted, and finally crushed by the times in which he lives. Even so, he takes pause before embarking on an insane plan to save his failing business. But time is money, saith the world of 1976, and the pause is regrettably brief.
I'll do it!
Miniature generators charge the exoskeleton costume, boot jets flare into life. Stuart Clark smiles inwardly at this gut-level justice his scheme offers. He plans to take what he needs to revive Clark Futuristics from FDIC-protected banks. By the way, the FDIC means the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That way, or so he thinks, no real people will suffer loss. The bank's losses will be covered by the government, the very government whose ill-conceived policies caused the recession which has put his business into such dire straits. He thinks this is poetic. In 1 hour, this humble poet, whom the authorities will dub Rampage, will become the most wanted man in Los Angeles. Elsewhere, Angel, wings tucked into a blue turtleneck and a purple suit, meets with Yvonne and Black Widow and Hercules, who's still shirtless in his skirt, in a public restaurant. And yes, of course, the people are staring.
I haven't been able to contact the Ghost Rider, and the Iceman is still with Fenster, but there's no reason we...
Thou seekest to include Hercules too swiftly, Angel. Though I have come here at the behest of the beauteous Natasha, I care not for thy desire to place the Lion of Olympus at the command of mere mortals.
I'll get my violin.
That's not exactly what Warren had in mind by the champions becoming storefront superheroes, Hercules.
You've palled around with enough other superhero types to know most are too involved in their own affairs, vital as those may be, to be of much help to the average man. I think we, the champions, can change that. I'm talking about extending a needed hand when ordinary people face out-of-the-ordinary problems. Like those patients Dr. Lansing turned into monsters. We've got power, mister, and that equals heavy responsibility in my book. Can you walk away from that?
You tell him, kid!
Thou dost speak with conviction, Angel. For the nonce, Hercules will join thee!
The balance. One decides, another ponders. Outside, in a white button-down with purple jacket and brown pants, Robert Drake walks, lost in thought. Without realizing it, he's giving off a wave of cold around him.
I hope Warren sells the others on this group. The more manpower he's got, the easier it'll be for me when I decide to split. I'm not like Warren. If I go public, I risk losing my secret identity. What effect would that have on the rest of the Drake family?
Two women named Anna and Rose walk by.
What's wrong, Rose? You're shivering.
Oh, I don't know, Anna. All of a sudden, this strange chill came over me.
Besides, I may want to chuck this whole Iceman bit someday and live a normal life. Uh-oh, I guess someday is still a ways off. Because unless this bank goes in for way out promotions, it's being robbed.
And we're going to talk about it, but if you did not read This Is Iceman Gay, then we got to talk. Drake peers into the window of the National Bank and sees Stuart Clark holding the bank manager in the air by his jacket. A cop is down on the ground.
Please, I...
Not clever, mister. Time lock or not, no bank is going to leave itself unable to open its vault during business hours. Skip it, friend. It's probably just as well I show the city what I can do now. Otherwise, the next time I get lied to, I might just lose my temper and hurt somebody.
And Clark simply grabs the bank vault door with a crunch and rips it off with a rip. And outside, Robert Drake is covering himself with ice, shattering his outer layer of clothing and forming a trail of ice underneath him to slide into the bank on, while growing a big ol' ice stick to hit the bad guy with.
Well, it does look like the time for the Iceman to cometh once again. So, I wonder if the champs will pay for all the threads I freeze-dried out of existence with this quick change number. I have to talk to Wings about that. But in the proverbial meantime, gangway, folks, the Iceman Express will stop him cold.
But Iceman is quickly humbled as Clark punches him, knocking him right through the bank window and out into the street. Rop! Crash!
Not likely, punk.
Ugh, sheesh. If my battering ram hadn't absorbed the brunt of that punch, little Bobby Drake would have been busted into as many pieces as that window. I don't even get a breather. That Joker is charging at me like a mad bull.
Wow. As the villain comes flying through the window, Iceman generates a series of ice balls and flings them.
You think you can stop me with this ineffectual barrage, Iceman?
That's the general idea, Chuckles.
With a wrench, Clark rips a full light post out of the ground and swats Iceman with it.
Don't waste time taking it to the patent office, little man, because as ideas go, it isn't worth much.
My head feels like a soggy marshmallow. If he connects again.
But here comes the Angel to the rescue, grabbing Iceman by the armpits and flying him into the air as the lamppost slams into the ground.
Didn't your mom and I warn you to stay away from the neighborhood bully, Junior?
Warren.
Coming to you via the courtesy of the one Eastern in LA that plays new broadcasts instead of Muzak.
News broadcasts instead of Muzak. He's referencing a radio statement, like he heard about the battle on the radio.
Coming to you via the courtesy of the one Eastern LA that plays news broadcasts instead of Muzak.
The Iceman's extra weight is slowing you down, Angel. You're just giving me two targets for the cut rate price of one.
And now Hercules is here. He grabs the light post on the other end. Clunch, and the two men both push against the other, the pole buckling between them. Scrack, skrrr.
I think not, villain. Not well. Hercules calls them comrades.
I've heard that several of you superheroes had banded together, but it makes little difference to me. One or ten, I can smash you all.
Stars, though thou dost howl like a jackal, thy strength rivals that of the golden-crested titans.
Strength enough to crush you, Hercules.
But Hercules is the stronger man, throwing the light post aside.
I said thy might rivaled that of the titans, not that of the Prince of Power.
You pulled it right out of the magnetic grippers, but I'll finish you off hand to hand.
By the gods, the man is crazed.
Who's finishing who off hand to hand? Thanks, Iceman. Magnetic grippers close in Clark's fists with a brack, and he hits the godling, with Hercules seeing stars. With a simple punch back, however, the new villain is thrown into the wall, which collapses around his now unconscious body. Foom!
Hardly, Hercules. Could a madman develop armor powerful enough to fell even a swaggering Olympian?
Momentarily, crazed one, but only momentarily. Of all the mysteries this earth holds, I shall never understand how a mortal can gain such power and then do so little with it.
Angel, Iceman, Black Widow, and Yvonne stand nearby.
I suppose Ares is a Boy Scout.
I wouldn't make light of Hercules, Angel.
Oh, don't worry about Natasha. He's too busy congratulating himself to take offense.
Ares is the god of war, my friend. It'd be his nature to act as he does.
Hercules!
Too late, lady. You didn't figure on this rig's protective power.
Clark is back up and on Hercules, knocking him down and pushing his face into the sidewalk. Club smash!
He's creaming Herc.
Come on, Wings. Let's get him.
He's creaming Herc. Come on, Wings. We gotta go.
Those fool kids are going after that jerk like he was the only supervillain in town.
And without a battle plan, they don't stand a chance.
Pilot on, Bobby. He's starting to bust through that overgrown ice cube already.
It's not going to work, Flyboy. Get out of...
Arrgh. Iceman tried forming a block of ice around Stuart Clark, but he flexes and scatters it. Crack! And an ice block hits Bobby in the head. Walk! Angel swoops in and punches Clark, but the helmet hurts his hand. Clark is ready with another backhanded slap. Swat!
Arrgh!
Herc's down, Bobby's down, and I'm only gonna get this one free shot before... Yo!
Idiot! My helmet is made of the same invincible alloy as the rest of my armor, but judge for yourself. I'd better grab whatever money I can, then get out of here. Once they've cleared the area, the cops will be getting into this too.
But before he can re-enter the bank, the Black Widow's ready with a sting. Zat! Clark avoids the Widow's punch as Yvonne and Hercules close in.
The Black Widow! I haven't come this far to be stopped by a mere woman!
No? Then what'll you offer for her partner and an extremely irritated demigod?
Get thee back, Ivan!
Sorry, Herc. First come, first serve!
Clark socks Ivan. Buck! But then Hercules throws Clark into a car. Whack! By then, Clark picks up the car and throws it at the heroes. But Iceman has an ice shield ready, and it shatters into cubes as the car strikes.
The angel's still out, but the others are regrouping. I've got to stop them.
Well done, my young ally. Thy ice shield has protected Natasha and thyself from harm. But now Hercules will fuck you, silly. But now Hercules will put an end to this.
Hercules, wait, don't fuck him, silly. Hercules, wait!
Listen to the lady, Herc. That creep's got us by the short hairs.
Back off, man god! If you come one step closer, I'll smash this fist right through the angel's skull.
And sure enough, Rampage has Angel by the hair and a fist raised. To be continued! Now, these are the kinds of superhero adventures we are here for, right?
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Friends, this is excellent. There's a lot of delicious content in this issue. This is where the champion starts to find its stride. Those first few issues are just kind of like, oh, there's your fun palate cleansers, but this is where it starts to get it's a really fun ride from here through the end of the series. Let's open with the journey of Stuart Clark Rampage. It is bizarre to see the narrator giving so much love and affection toward, like, look at this guy who's a violent asshole, but he's really a good guy. It's just the economy that's making him punch innocent people in the face and threaten civilians, which is a crazy read. This guy fucking hates Iron Man so much. He has a long history. We're going to be giving him a lot of attention in the new year on the show.
Well, I think he's filled with anger. I think it's safe to say that. he was not likable. And so that's why I sort of turned him into a Hulk Hogan type. I just was, yeah. Even when they sort of like were trying to sympathize with him, I was like, but he's kind of a douche too. Like, this is not the right path.
He has a crazy history.
I actually do think it's kind of interesting to have his story presented sort of in juxtaposition to Angel inheriting all this money from his parents. Because during the recession, all these people are suffering, obviously, some blame floating around and things like that. But then having like Angel come into all this money because, you know, inheritance is recession proof. So I think that's a fun kind of interesting comparison to draw there.
Yeah, we go from I'm rich to declare bankruptcy, you spineless worm. Like the next page, it's delicious.
Yeah, as a actual bankruptcy attorney in real life.
Wait, really?
Yeah, that's what I do. And I was like, oh God, I've been in this situation before.
You created supervillains.
People turn into supervillains after they've been.
There's a couple of them. I would not put it past them. Yeah.
Kevin, is it a Snicktra kicked on Rampage's costume?
Oh my God, it's such a Snicked. I love everything about it. And I love that you took such great pains to describe every bit of it. But people should be looking at this issue because the fashion throughout is amazing. This is full 70s, blue turtlenecks, purple pants. Like, it's everybody is looking excellent in this.
This isn't stated directly on the page, but this is Angel in his like ketchup and mustard colors. And Rampage is in the same colors. It's almost as though he's the inversion of the entitled Playboy, which is really interesting. But he's very the white guy whose company failed, which fucking sucks. I get it. The American dream failed this guy. But also Tony Stark like beat him to the patent. And like that's his whole origin story. It's a lot to consider.
I get it. I think, listen, yeah, you shouldn't punch random people, but he's not. He's just punching a billionaire and a god and a twink. And like the recession made me want to do all those things too. I get it. I sympathize. I sympathize with this man.
Is that it's a D.B. Cooper reference in the subtitle, correct? With the
money out
of the airplane. So this is that period of time too where, you know, that fantasy of like being the super spy that gets away with all the money was like kind of glorified back in that 70s because the recession was so bad. So like, I get what Rampage is about. And I get why the narrator sympathizes a bit because that period of time, especially he was the Luigi of the time.
It would be really interesting to interview Jenny Isabella about 1976 and what she might've been going through recession wise. But if the government's going to steal from us, why can't we steal from the government? Seems to be kind of the message. Now, Angel has a really complicated family story. We've covered a lot of it on the show, but his uncle Dazzler, the first Dazzler, Burt Worthington, murdered his father, who was a member of the Hellfire Club and like one of the richest men in the world, and then tried to marry Angel's mother, but then poisoned her to death. And then the Dazzler got arrested. There's a whole journey that Angel's been on here. So Jenny Isabella kind of taking the through lines of Angel's family story, which has been kind of behind the scenes. One time Magneto kidnapped Angel's parents and tried to use their DNA to create a race of like mutant androids. If you've listened to the show for a long time, we've covered all that old Silver Age stuff. But this is Angel like, my parents sent me off to boarding school. I don't really know what their company is, and my human relatives want to take the money because they're arguing that my parents wouldn't have given it to me if they'd known I was a mutant. So we're seeing some anti-mutant hysteria show up here, but also I'm rich, we should be superheroes, that'll be fun, we can play with our friends forever.
Yeah, well, coming as a lower middle class kind of guy, it was fun to imagine what it would be like if your parents secretly had all this money. I guess I'm still kind of waiting to see if my dad's got something socked away, and that one day I could pretend to be super wealthy, and then I'll invite all of you to be in my superhero club. We only need 20 or 30 floors, not a big deal. Real easy. But no, it's surprising to me that he's so surprised about it, I guess. Like, even though he doesn't know what his parents are doing, what the company's about or whatnot, like, I don't know. How are rich people so oblivious? I don't understand.
They're rich.
I saw Josh Johnson, if you guys follow the comedian Josh Johnson, do a commentary a few weeks back on billionaires. You can find it on YouTube if you want to watch the clip. But he's kind of like, there's a point where if you got several million dollars, there's like four things you would do with it, right? You'd pay off all your debt, you'd pay off all your family and friends' debt, you'd like take some big vacations and buy some toys, maybe you'd give some money back into charity. But what if you finish all that and you still have $5 billion? He's like, there's a point where you don't comprehend the money anymore. And there's an interesting thing of like Angel's like, oh, let's buy a building and be superheroes, because he becomes the funding source for the X-Men later as well. We also have direct canon reference that one of the reasons Xavier recruited Angel was because he had a lot of family money, which is crazy to me because he's the guy that just flies and punches things, right? Like there's there's a whole journey for him here. We also have to talk about Iceman here. Iceman's reactions to Angel and the deep commentary of his closetedness veiled under the idea of him being a mutant who can't be exposed because his family might found out. I have not been able to interview Jenny Isabella about this, but we know Jenny, the writer of this book, is a trans woman. You have to wonder how much of that's coming out in Iceman's dialogue here.
You know, I've read a significant amount of Iceman, including modern Iceman, where he is often depicted actually having sex with men. This is possibly the gayest Iceman story I have ever read. And the mutant closeted metaphor is really coming through very, very strongly here. You know, he's concerned about being outed to his parents, and his beautiful roommate from boarding school just inherited billions and billions of dollars, and suddenly Bobby's like, what are we gonna do? It's a lot. There's a lot going on here. And to echo what Kevin said before, you really have to actually look at the comic, because Bobby's outfit here is also insane.
For X-Men fans, this is a particularly delicious issue.
It's funny because he's around, everyone became slightly gayer. They're like, just gotta hand over this, gotta hand over fit, like, let me just sob. And you're like, okay, we get it. But everyone just in his cold orbit like became slightly gayer, which I appreciate it. Even the dialogue became gayer when he like showed up, which I really
do. Did they all know he's gay and he doesn't, and they're all just trying to push him along, right?
Oh, I think there's several ways to read that, but at this point we have to assume that the writers maybe were playing with some hints of identity without the direct parallel. I do not think it was Jenny's specific intent to say this character is gay, but clearly playing on the themes of closetedness, playing a different idea about secret identity and what that means. And Bobby and Warren come from very different places, right? Bobby had loving parents who were kind of assholes, but Warren was completely estranged from his parents in boarding school. So there's some really different ways to kind of read that journey. We also have this delicious opening scene with Hercules and the football players, and then Hercules fighting this guy in a tech suit later. Sean, welcome back as the delicious voice of Hercules always.
Thank you. Yeah, Hercules is fun in this one. I like how he's kind of like studying American customs and not really getting it, but just going along, and everybody's trying to take him down, but you can't stop Hercules. I love this guy.
All the flattened football players like, oh, I should have gone into philosophy.
Yeah.
Michael Hamm, where do you think Mr. Ghost Rider was off to this issue?
You're gonna have to read his newly released issues on his solo series to find out, according to this. I have no idea. I've never fully been a Ghost Rider fan. Does anyone here know where he is, what he's doing?
Oh, the Ghost Rider title in the 70s is nuts. We just can't take the time to read it on this show. There's a lot of great 70s shit, like in the Defenders. But if you want to go back and have just a delicious 1970s journey, go read Ghost Rider Volume 2 from 1976. It's insane. He has some crazy supervillains, from Water Wizard to the Orb. There's so many great, like, weird camp villains over there.
I just want him to come back. I can't keep making up all these offensive accents and stuff, so I need to just go back to one.
He'll be back next issue, I promise.
Thank God.
But thank you for playing some dueling characters. It's really fun to hear you do voice work, my friend.
Awful.
And then we go over to Christie as the Black Widow, which, my word, this is delicious. So Black Widow's offering this very insightful speech about, you know, actually, this could work. Like, this team might work. Look at all of us. We're all losers.
Sorry. This is a bad slip. I mean, there is something that is kind of sweet about this, you know, former brainwashed super spy, Russian assassin, Soviet era craziness, you know, obviously defected, who's gone through multiple superhero teams at this point, always gets burned, always ends up in a bad place and worse off than where she started. And yet here comes another superhero team. And she's like, you know what? Maybe this time.
Maybe this time I'll get lucky.
And like, there's like a naivete there that I kind of appreciate, but also like, you know, Natasha can, you know, keep out some hope for humanity and her skills being useful and being on a team. And you can, I mean, it really does feel like, you know, this is kind of a found family situation for her, as I'm sure the Avengers were. And so, yeah, I really love this for her. Like, it's silly, it's campy, it's queer as hell. And she kind of feels a little bit like a fag hag in this situation, but like in the best way possible. I think that's pretty much what she's going to get. So I love that for her.
I'm not in a hurry, but there will eventually be a Christy Porter, Kevin Canary, Chad Anderson review of the character Yvonne Petrovich on the
channel. Yeah.
We'll get there.
Their relationship is wild.
Yeah, Yvonne's interesting because he's this like 100-year-old like Russian man, but they kind of write him like he's like an old cowboy. But Kevin, your face every time you go Russian makes me smile. I love it.
It takes a lot to get that accent out. Like it's going through a lot of things in my mouth.
He gets a little humbled by the end.
Well, and there's something interesting about his relationship, especially in this one. You know, he's in it a little bit more than we've seen, and he's kind of a hanger on to all of this. And he's not really invited to this party. It's Black Widow who's been invited to the party, and he's just like, "Hey, I'm here too." But to Christy's point, he's really concerned about her in that what I think is a very sweet way of like, "You've gone through some trouble in the past. Let me watch out for you. You're going to fall for this again. Let's see, make sure you're set up and safe and successful." And so there's something sweet about it. I know it doesn't stay sweet, but like at least right now, it's kind of lovely. And I appreciate it.
This is a delicious journey for all of these characters. I really enjoy this run. I think this is the start of where the Champions gets amazing. So I'm excited to take all this ride with all of you as we get into the new year. It's been delicious putting these dynamics together with each of you on these ongoing reads, and I'm just having so much fun. So thank you all for celebrating these 70s comics with me. Follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram. We're wrapping December up with just kind of some final script reads and all of the journeys we've been taking, and the new year will launch into some really crazy places. In December, we're balancing out the seriousness of the fascism conversations in November, whereas the theme on my show in December is going to be eyeballs. So we're going to be talking all about eyeball characters. It'll be a delicious way to round out the year. And then we're launching into Nightcrawler in the new year. So everybody be prepared for that in 2026.
So final thoughts. This comic was fun. It was interesting seeing like Iceman back in the day when he does kind of suck. I understand now why the adults told me they didn't like Iceman when I was growing up, because like he can't shatter anything yet. He's just that ice dude who says gay stuff. So I get it, older people. But you can find me on Solving for X and X-Men Task Podcast. This year we launched our website, solvingforxmen.com. That'll link you to our X-Dramas, Two Mutant to Handle, and A Nightmare on Greymalkin Lane. And we just finished WandaVision, and we're getting into Agatha All Along. Fun, fun, fun.
Yeah, my takeaway and my advice to everybody is please be nice to your bankruptcy attorneys. And you can find me on most social media, Scott Free. I have my own podcast, The Clone Conspiracy, where we discuss Ben Reilly and the Clone Saga. So check it out.
I just want to say it's very fun to come on this and do some outrageous characters, so I appreciate it. It's a fun little getaway, and you really have to get in the like sort of the headspace of these characters. But when it's 60s, 70s, I always just think it's the craziest voices ever. And it was in the 60s and 70s. But it's such a good time. You can find me.
You've taken us from The Huntsman to Billy to Rampage. It's delightful watching your journey.
Yeah, but you can find me and the rest of the Homo Superior Podcast boys at Homo Superior Podcast on Instagram. And there you can find our links for everything else. But join our Discord, because we have a lot of chats. We talk about all the stupid things in the world. And then we get a little creepy over the holidays too. So come and join us.
Well, you're a little creepy every day, my friend.
Final thoughts are that my incredible portrayal of Anne, famously Anne, looks so much like Dorothy from the Golden Girls, and she calls the other character Rose. And I was following along with the comic. So to get that Easter egg, you got to actually go read the comic, because it blew my mind when I was reading it. And that's my final thought. And me personally, I don't really do anything, but if you'd like to see the wares that I'm shilling, you can find me at hammy73 on instagram.com.
Great to see you, man.
You know that website, instagram.com. That's the one.
Yeah, this was a fun issue, very timely, as I think you said earlier in the show. But it was good. It was fun. And again, I will let you all know if I inherit those billions. In the meantime, you can find me on Instagram at illustrator.mike. And probably my biggest news, there's a local comic shop here in San Francisco called Silver Sprocket that started carrying my book Branches and a couple of my zines. If anyone is interested in checking those out, Silver Sprocket's store website is store.silversprocket.net.
So final thoughts on this. I gotta say, it's fascinating to me that we're at issue 5 and they're just finally starting to form the team. I love like a slow burn in a way, and I think that's something that not all teams always have when they're forced together editorially, so I like that they kind of play with that. Also, Ryan, your crazy eyes when you were doing Rampage is a joyous thing. When you got into it, your eyes were insane in the best way. I'm Kevin Kadairi, and I am so happy and honored always to be a guest on these podcasts. I don't have a podcast of my own, so I just glom off of everybody else. I'll be on an upcoming episode of Subtext Men, as well as some future script reads for Gray Malkin Lane, and then you can see me in person. I'll be at WonderCon, and then a bunch of other conventions, including Uncanny Experience in New York Comic Con next year, or this year, whenever you're listening, in soonly 2026.
And Christy.
Final thoughts? I think if this comic came out today, you'd probably be called In This Economy. But, you know, being a millennial, you can only live through so many recessions before you're like, oh. Let's see. I am at Christy Porter on Blue Sky, and I am a producer, cosplayer, journalist, many hats. Ooh, gosh. I have a Kickstarter that, while we're recording this, is to be launched soon with an anthology. I got a story in it that my and my partner did together. It's called Witching Season. So many months later, look for that. Hopefully that gets picked up with some retailers and you'll be able to find it.
Wonderful to see you all. Just a joy. Let's close today by saying the best line from the script, which is, they're creaming hurt. Thanks for everybody. Take care of yourselves. We'll see you back here early next year with some more Champions content in 2026. Bye!
And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. When Italy entered World War II in June 1940, Benito Mussolini imagined himself as the heir to the Roman emperors, expanding Italy's reach across the Mediterranean and Africa alongside his ideological twin, if you will, Adolf Hitler. These two dictators had formalized their partnership the previous year with the Pact of Steel in 1939, look it up, pledging mutual military and political support to each other's countries. Yet, Italy was woefully unprepared for modern warfare. Its army lacked fuel, equipment, and effective leadership. Mussolini's ill-fated invasions of Greece and North Africa in 1940 and 41 quickly turned disastrous, forcing Hitler to divert German troops to rescue his ally, first in the Balkans and then again in North Africa. This dependency quietly humiliated Mussolini and began eroding Italy's internal confidence in fascist rule. So by 1943, the Axis position was collapsing. The Allied invasion of Sicily and Operation Husky in July 1943 marked a critical blow. As Allied forces advanced, Italian morale plummeted and fascist support evaporated. On July 25th, 1943, Mussolini was deposed by his own Grand Council of Fascism, arrested on orders of King Victor Emmanuel III, and replaced by Marshal Pietro Badoglio. I had to figure out how to say this last name. Marshal Pietro Badoglio. Though Badoglio publicly declared that Italy would continue fighting beside Germany, he secretly began negotiating an armistice with the Allies. On September 8th, 1943, the new Italian government announced the surrender. Germany, enraged at what Hitler called a stab in the back, immediately launched Operation Ascia, seizing control of Italy and disarming its former allies' troops. The betrayal's impact was profound and tragic. Hitler ordered Mussolini rescued from captivity in a daring commando raid led by Otto Skorzeny, instilling him as the puppet leader of the Italian Social Republic in Nazi-occupied northern Italy. The rest of the country descended into chaos. German forces occupied Rome and committed atrocities against civilians, while a brutal civil war erupted between fascists and Italian partisans. Italy's defection opened the southern front for the Allies, but the campaign through the Apennines proved long and bloody. By the time Mussolini was captured and executed by Italian resistance fighters in April 1945, the dream of a fascist empire had ended in ruin, its betrayal of and by Nazi Germany leaving Italy deeply scarred and politically transformed for generations. Now we're jumping to our new Red Skull story, Captain America Volume 3, beginning in number 15. At last, at long last, how I have longed for the sensation to command the reality-shaping power of the cosmic cube from within
within. Kang tells the Red Skull that he's about to achieve dominance over Earth for the next few centuries. Later, Captain America and Sharon Carter find the Watcher waiting in their home, which is always a bad sign in the Marvel Universe, just before the Red Skull attacks, manipulating reality around himself. Rogers, Carter, how nice to see you again. He manipulates the floor to bend and hold them in place, warps reality to put Captain America back in his costume. He briefly twists their faces into Red Skulls. I could, of course, kill you where you stand, but doing so would rob me of the greater joy of watching your face collapse in horror at the sight of the world to come, a world in which every truth and ideal you fight for has become nothing more than a fairy tale. My world. Make the most of your final moments. They will not last. So the Watcher shows the heroes a version of America underneath the Red Skull. It's very, It's a Wonderful Life. The Guardian Angel showing the alternate reality. A nation populated, quote, by 270 million slaves and one dictator. There is no liberty anymore. There is no justice. Every freedom you or any soldier has ever championed is now meaningless, forgotten like a dream burned away by the dawn's harsh sun. The people of this land are too far gone, Captain, to ever be recovered. In the future, the Skull rules America totally and completely with a tyranny that will continue unabated for centuries to come. Nazi overseers ride on the backs of lizard steeds. The hero's corpses have been hung on display. A golden statue of the Red Skull stands over everything. And it happened in less than a day. In 16, we see America bastardized. The photo of raising the flag on Iwo Jima is superimposed over a devastated landscape. The Lincoln Memorial lies in rubble. The Red Skull replaces it. But there's still time to fix it. Back in the past, in his gold armor, the Red Skull forces Thor to polish his boots while he tortures the Scarlet Witch. But then the Skull realizes that this reality only remains when he's able to keep his focus. The Watcher teaches Cap that in order to stop the Skull, he'll have to kill him. But Cap refuses, wanting to hold to his morals. Testing his powers, the Skull delivers a heat wave famine to New York, watching the civility and the people wither away in their hunger as they begin to fight each other for scraps. He floods the city of Oxford, Mississippi, watching civilians cling to rooftops for survival. He blankets Los Angeles with an enduring winter, watching the civilians struggle for shelter. And in each place, Cap is there to fight back, until the Skull reverts him back to his 98-pound weakling version of Steve Rogers once again. In 17, the Red Skull with his absolute power is just the happiest person you have ever seen. He's smiling and throwing his arms around as he rains chaos on the earth. He rides a dragon to devastate Washington, D.C. Delightful! America's capital at last stands revealed for what I have always known it to be, a quagmire endangered by prehistoric ideas. What better place than the heart of the falling American dynasty to establish a new Skull nation and rip asunder these embarrassing monuments to fools long dead? And Cap retorts, the strength of this country isn't in buildings of brick and steel. It's in the hearts of those who have sworn to fight for freedom against any foe, no matter how great the odds. Cap is restored to full strength, and there's a big, playful fist fight as the city around them burns. But then Skull tosses him in a tar pit. After summoning the ship of Galactus from across space, the Red Skull is prepared to enter it, and thus achieve kind of cosmic dominance, as the Watcher warns Cap that it's now or never. So Cap stabs the Red Skull with an energy spear in the back, feeling like he has no choice but to kill him. But surprise, it wasn't the Watcher at all, it was Kang the Conqueror in disguise. And now Michael Korvac has the Cosmic Cube. We're not going to talk about Korvac today, it's an old Avengers foe who gets god powers. Finally, in 18 and 19, Korvac is now able to become Galactus and take over the world, so the Red Skull was getting tricked by Kang the whole time. So now we get to see the reality where he doesn't kill the Red Skull, but then that thwarts the plans of Kang and Korvac, but it also allows the Red Skull to get on the ship of Galactus and pilfer its secrets. This is exquisite! My mind fills with the secrets of the cosmos, galactic mysteries, atomic enigmas, they unravel within me as with crystal clarity. There is nothing I cannot do! And then he visualizes his face and hands as bigger than cities. Like, this is his big dream. There's more fighting. He makes Sharon fight Cap. As they fight, Thousand Skulls yell, kill! But he ends up disappearing in the data stream of the Galactus energy. It overwhelms him. And oh my god, is this the Red Skull? Is the genie from Aladdin? Okay, I know that was a lot of an introduction, but let me welcome my incredible friend Julio Anta back to the show. Hi, Julio. I hope you enjoyed that performance.
I enjoyed the voices, especially. You could be a voice actor.
Are you a Red Skull fan, my friend?
You know, I can't say I'm a Red Skull fan, but I do enjoy stories where Red Skull is the antagonist in it.
He is a terrible villain. The baseline of evil every time. I don't know if you've read much of his history or even seen this kind of era of Captain America books. It's pretty powerful storytelling here.
Yeah, no, this was my first time reading this era, this like Wade era. What year is this? It's in the early 90s? Or
No, early 2000s, around 2000.
Early 2000s, okay. Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah. No, it was definitely my first time reading this. this. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it obviously had a lot of powerful commentary, even if the stories are a little, but wait, it's actually Kang, and then this, and then that. It's very, you know, it really feels like Wade just trying to like one-up himself every issue and just make it a little crazier, a little twistier each time. But I enjoyed it.
I don't know if you know that old monster movie, The Blob, like it just, as it consumes, mm-hmm. it grows, and whatever it flows over, it keeps growing. That's kind of the Red Skull in stories like this, where no matter mm-hmm. how much he takes over and devastates, he just wants to keep expanding bigger, bigger, bigger. Yeah. Where were you in 2003?
In 2003, I was 13. And
I was 15. We're like this. No. I was 20. I was 25. I lied.
Yeah, 13. Wow. Okay. So 13 was is a really, 2003 is a very, like 2003, 2004 is so pivotal in my development as the person that I am today. It's when I first really became politicized as a kid, as a teenager. The Iraq War was the first time that I think had my own, I realized that my own beliefs were different than my family's, my communities, and, you know, the mainstream of what US politics was pushing on us. You know, I remember watching the day that the bombs were dropping on Baghdad, shock and awe, and just thinking without having the language for it, but just intrinsically feeling inside of me that this is wrong, you know, that people are dying. Even though, you know, I saw people celebrating it, it just felt wrong. And I didn't have the political education to really understand why it was wrong, but it was just something that was in me. And around this time is also when, you know, I have started getting into music really heavily, punk and hardcore bands who are political in their orientation, you know, and who are writing songs and singing songs about that are anti-war. And I'm seeing for the first time that there are adults who have a different political perspective than the one that I've been raised under. So it's really just like this hugely eye-opening period in my life where I'm also discovering music and going to shows for the first time, to like local DIY concerts where I'm meeting people who are openly queer for the first time, people who are vegan, people who are anti-war, like all of these things that are so different than the world, the like sort of, without getting too personal, like the evangelical world that I was brought up in up until that point. So yeah, kind of interesting that this comic came out at the same time that I'm really going through a bit of a transformation as a teenager.
So there's this careful balance of power. It's interesting to me, we've been doing a lot of like fascism conversations on my show lately. Captain America kind of represents these old baby boomer values, you know, from a bygone time, and his ability to adapt to a new America. But the focal point in this story is, will he kill the Red Skull or not? And the Red Skull is like the Nazi war criminal responsible for millions of deaths. So that being the focal decision is like, where is that line of decency? Is it a really interesting one?
I mean, I think you kill Red Skull. You know, it's this is easier than baby Hitler. You know, this is
a man with his finger on the nuke, metaphorically speaking. Yes,
exactly. You know, I laugh reading this because, you know, Cap obviously really struggles with this. And he has a conversation with Peggy where it's been a minute since I read them, but she's trying to like, she's surprised that he won't do it, right? Or is it with her or with somebody else?
Yeah, Sharon is very willing to do.
Oh, Sharon, that's Sharon. Right.
Yeah, Peggy's her aunt.
Yeah. But yeah, so Sharon is like ready to, you know, to kill Red Skull. Cap has moral issue with that. You know, at the end of the day, it's all okay. But yeah, that's it. For me, super easy decision. Snap my fingers and he's gone, you know, and we avoid this fascist takeover, this, you know, everything that he stands for.
We have the Red Skull calling America's capital, being revealed for what he's always known it to be, a quagmire endangered by prehistoric ideas, which is a crazy phraseology, but there's always been a very thin line between white supremacy and Nazism, right? Like, it's not that hard. So 2025 being kind of the ultimate comparison here, how are you doing? It's the craziest of my friends.
You know, it's interesting because we are recording this on November 10th. We are almost a week from, I live in New York City, where we elected Zoran Mamdani to be mayor, which I think a lot of the country is seeing as a glimmer of hope. And for us in New York, who campaigned for him and canvassed for him, it's been a lot of work. And now, you know, we saw that work come to fruition. And, you know, for the first time in a really long time, we won and we feel good about something. But at the same time, you know, there is this ever descent into fascism that we've been facing since since the first Trump administration, but especially now with the second.
But also since the formation of our country, you know, where we compromised over slavery.
Of course. Every single day we get another piece of bad news. But in the midst of it, you know, we get some good news. Obviously, last week we elected Zoran. But today also, the Supreme Court just announced that they were not going to take up the case to sort of destroy the same-sex marriage case. So, you know,
we're legit listeners recording this on the morning where that got announced, like an hour ago.
Yeah,
it'll be a few weeks before this comes out, but there's always these time markers, you know?
Yeah, so we'll see if this comes back to bite us and this bit of good news is appealed or some, you know, who knows? But yeah, so there are glimmers of hope. You know, we live in a country that is insists on capitulating to Trump, you know, both parties, you know, again, to, you know, continue to break the kayfabe of what day it is. You know, last night, it looks like the Democrats are capitulating to fund the government without accepting the ACA being renewed. It's a tough situation that we find ourselves in with not many heroes on either side to sort of save us from this fascism. But, you know, so I take it day by day.
Yeah.
I have my orientation towards all this right now is pretty negative, but, you know, I take the wins where we can get them.
I have never lost faith in humans, in community, in you know, intellectualism and art. But it is hard to avoid that kind of slow erosion of like exhaustion that we're all feeling, I think, these days. Now, I opened with this kind of historical anecdote, which I feel like we could just cut and paste into today's history, which is what this research is crazy for me. But, you know, Hitler and Mussolini signing their Pact of Steel, even the fact that they named it that sounds so trumpeted. But then when things start falling apart for Italy, you know, Germany comes to their rescue. There's these betrayals. Mussolini's arrested. And then like Hitler takes over the north of Italy, rescues Mussolini, and then puts him in as like the puppet governor in the new fascist part. Like, this is history I don't think we learn very often. Did you have thoughts
on
kind of historical comparison?
Yeah. You know, there are so many moments that I've had since I sort of became politically conscious where I start realizing that, wow, like we weren't taught this because we weren't supposed to know this. You know, these are, you know, just everything from, you know, I never learned in school, obviously, all of the Nazi scientists that we sort of brought into the country and, you know, sort of forgave their sins and used their knowledge to further our own, whether it was with NASA or our own just like imperialist desires. I don't know. Every day I learn something new that shocks me in a new way. But yeah, there's so many parallels to obviously Hitler and Mussolini and World War II in the moment that we're living in today. I think I go back to the point that you made earlier about community. That's what I put my faith in. You know, I put my faith in people who are organizing around their communities, who are, you know, in this moment where SNAP is being, you know, chopped in half and so many people are going to start going hungry. Communities that are organizing. I just watched a video of people in Atlanta who were organizing like free breakfast for their community, you know, and all these mutual aid funds. And, you know, I think it shows that the things that we do as a community is what the government should be doing to take care of us. We have billions of dollars for war to commit genocide around the world, but we don't have money to take care of our own people here. And I think that is true with Hitler's Germany. It's true with what we're living through today. And this just war profiteering and warmongering is really, I think, a pretty apt sign of a crumbling empire, for better or for worse, you know?
Yeah, one of the things that I find so frustrating and jarring, I live in Salt Lake City, so you and I got to see each other at NYCC and talk about this a little bit, but, you know, Charlie Kirk was killed 20 miles from my house, and I was at the scene of that place for a week doing crisis work. I have a cousin who, she and her husband were hit with tear gas and rubber bullets at a peaceful protest by the ICE thing in Portland, and then just 3 weeks ago, I witnessed four people who were being detained by ICE outside a facility for well over an hour, and I just sat there and I couldn't do anything. There's four Hispanic people, you know, on their knees on the ground as like their cars being explored by cops that aren't even in cop uniforms, you know.
Yeah.
I like wept for days. So the thing for me is it feels like the circle's growing smaller, and I don't lose sight of the big hopeful things, but it doesn't take away from that crazy stuff either. I've referenced your book Home on my show multiple times, and I was thrilled to have you on the first time you came on to talk about Home. But boy, does your book read different than it did just 3 years ago, you know? How are you doing as a creator these days?
It's tough because I got my start in comics. Home published in 2021 is five single issues. And obviously, it, for those of you who are familiar, it takes place during the 2018 family separation crisis. So I got my start in comics as sort of a form of, I don't want to say, maybe saying therapy is making too much of it, but a way for me to sort of exercise my feelings of hopelessness and helplessness.
You're talking to a guy guy who makes the show. No, I understand. Yeah.
But yeah, like to try to do something and express myself in the face of this crisis where I saw my father who came to this country when he was 5 years old, and I saw my son who was 3 years old at the time in the eyes of these children who were being ripped away from their parents. And, you know, the book published post the first Trump administration to publish during the Biden administration. But, you know, I think the wounds were still extremely raw. At least they were for me and for a lot of the people I reached out after they read it for the first time. And now, you know, I am feeling like I'm in that same place again where, you know, I feel like I need to create things that respond to the moment. You know, since then, you know, I've been publishing for 4 years and I've still, all of my work has been, you know, political in some way or another. But, you know, it definitely feels like we are in an urgent moment, and as artists we need to play a role in the urgency and in the moving the needle of getting people to open their eyes and realize that we need to take action before this continues to go off the cliff. So yeah, that's kind of where my mind is right now. So a lot of the projects that I am working on now that unfortunately won't be out, you know, for a little bit, all address the current moment that we're in some way or another.
Yeah. And on those early stories, I hope that you can hear very clearly, listeners, the people who rose up against Mussolini in these particular examples, because there was a whole populace ready to come in and take the government back, and people ready to help on all sides. So I'm grateful for alliances. I'm grateful for friendships. Grateful for you, my friend. Thank you for being an incredible storyteller and for spending your time with me this morning. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody, please take care of yourselves. Live joyfully. Be safe. We'll see you all back here next week. Thank you for listening to Graham Alkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Graham Alkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Graham Alkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Graham Alkin Lane.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.